real healers are not the folks who hang up a shingle outside their door. The people of power in these regions are tightly guarded, and often only moonlight as healers, working a regular job during daylight hours. These unorthodox magico-religious cultures are extremely fragile, and years of oppression and persecution at the hands of powerful entities like the Roman Catholic Church have taught them how to protect their wisdom and its keepers. Healers have organic firewalls built into the community around them and must be sought out through the proper channels. The only way you'll get in is if they want you to, or if some huge breach of trust occurs. So far, our unpromising list of candidates consists of a few individuals who I've met in preliminary excursions into the jungle, but who are not a great fit, and a list of elders whom I've read about in books, but most likely are no longer alive. The only other lead I have comes from two random phone calls I recently received from separate friends. The first was from my childhood buddy Mark, who upon hearing about our project, called to say he knew of a shaman who occasionally traveled through the United States and was supposed to be extremely powerful. He couldn't remember his name, but knew it started with an R. The second call was from my friend Pete, who was dating a woman who had begun to study with a medicine man in Peru named Roman. "She told me she'd be willing to make an introduction if you'd like one," Pete told me. "This guy sounds like the real deal." I turned to my computer screen to write Mark and Pete quick follow-up emails and noticed a web page is still up in the browser from a late-night research binge the night before. It's a simple site for a little retreat center in the upper Amazon basin, and there's a picture of a young man staring straight into the camera. Something about his face, particularly the eyes, stopped me in my tracks last night, and I still don't know why. Written under the photograph is the man's name, Roman Hannes. I immediately punch in Mark's Colorado phone number. He picks up, and I ask him if the name Roman Hannes rings a bell. "Yeah, that's the shaman I told you about. I knew it began with an R. How did you know it?" A quick call to Pete's girlfriend, Cynthia, confirms that the man she is speaking about is the very same Roman Hannes. It just so happens that he'll be giving a private talk in Brooklyn in a few weeks. 2 weeks later, I'm in a candlelit basement in a Russian neighborhood near Coney Island, sitting on one of the cushions ringed around a man whom synchronicity seems to have led me to. He is tall and slender, with long hair pulled back and tied loosely behind his head. Perched high on the bridge of his nose are a pair of thin-rimmed glasses, framing deep eyes that are wide open but devoid of noticeable emotion as he stares at those gathered around him. He is too light-skinned and sharp-featured to be an Amazonian native. "If you're here," he begins, looking slowly around the room, "it's most likely because you know someone who's already a part of our spirit family and has sat in our circle before. We've invited you here tonight because you have demonstrated interest in learning about the ceremonial work we do with Amazonian and Andean healing traditions. But before we bring a newcomer into a ceremony, we feel it's best to meet you beforehand and give you a download from the jungle. It is necessary for you to know the nature of this medicine and how it came to be. Please make yourself comfortable because the talk I'm about to give is long." Roman spends the better part of the next 3 hours describing the origins of Amazonian shamanism and the marriage between these powerful traditions and those of the Incan lineages in the neighboring Andes Mountains. He speaks to us of his own healing journey that started with his diagnosis with advanced Crohn's disease, a severe malady of the intestinal tract, when he was in his late teens living in Moldova, a small country in Eastern Europe. After trying a variety of modern medical procedures with minimal success, the doctors told him that they would need to remove large portions of his intestine as a last resort. Refusing to undergo this invasive surgery, he began seeking out other alternative treatments, ultimately being called to South America in his early 20s. In a remote jungle village in Peru, he met a Huitoto shaman named Don Sinchi, who was highly respected by the locals, and the elders agreed to help Roman get better. But the medicine man warned that he was about to enter one of the most trying periods of his life. The old healer brought Roman deep into the rainforest to a little hut by a river and opened the door. "This is where you will be staying." Inside, there was nothing but a hard wooden bed and a window. Willing to do anything to get better, Roman nodded his head in agreement. "What do we do now?" The shaman pointed into the hut and said, "This is what you do. I'll be back tomorrow." Don Sinchi turned to go, but then stopped. "I almost forgot," he said. "I need those." He pointed to Roman's backpack and possessions. Roman was skeptical and definitely didn't want to be robbed, but he was desperate and reluctant to insult the old man, so he did as he was told and handed over all his belongings. The afternoon and evening passed, and the shaman came back the next day with some herbs for Roman to take, along with a plate of cooked green plantains and quinoa. As Don Sinchi turned to leave, Roman asked him, "What am I supposed to do now?" "You are doing it," replied the shaman. The shaman visited him again one morning. A few weeks had passed, and Roman had barely left his hut but to relieve his basic human needs. Don Sinchi told him that they would be doing a ceremony that night, the sacred plant called ayahuasca. He sat down on the steps of Roman's hut and told him a tale of a great king who once ruled benevolently over a jungle empire that encompassed the entirety of what is now the Amazon rainforest. The king was so connected to the heavens that he only needed to look at a person who was ill, and he or she would be healed. The king lived for 100 years, but one day he knew it was time for him to leave this plane of existence. So he bid his people farewell and told them not to worry, that he would leave them a gift after he departed that would allow them to channel his special healing gifts and connect with the gods just as he did. He instructed them to bury his remains in a specific clearing deep in the forest, and after he left his physical body, they did exactly that. A few days later, 2 plants sprouted from his grave, a vine and a green leafy plant. The native herbalists knew this was a gift, and once the plants had matured, they took cuttings from each and began to experiment with them. This is how the sacred brew, known as ayahuasca, a medicine that is thought to be the most powerful of jungle medicines, came to be. Roman and Don Sinchi drank ayahuasca that night, and Roman spent the entire ceremony curled up in a ball, purging from both ends. The pain in his intestines flaring up violently as plant compounds moved their way through his body. There was nothing divine about this experience for him, aside from the relief he felt once it was over. Sitting in his hut the following morning, he felt the urge to leave the place, but something inside him told him that this was his only chance at getting better. So he stayed. 3 months passed. Day after day he spent in his tiny wilderness abode, with only the creatures and plants of the forest to keep him company. He was isolated in body and mind. The shaman came once or twice a day to give him food and herbal medicines, but that was it. Once or twice a week, there would be an ayahuasca ceremony, which gradually became less painful to Roman's sensitive intestinal tract, but there were still no visions or ethereal connections to a higher realm. He was beginning to lose himself in the forest, sometimes forgetting who he was. The symptoms of his Crohn's disease, which had defined him for so long, were also beginning to subside, no longer stabbing their way into his awareness each moment. 6 months into his healing journey, he was in the middle of an ayahuasca ceremony with Don Sinchi when suddenly everything he identified as himself began to melt into the darkness around him. He panicked, clinging feebly to the final threads of his persona, until those too slipped away. Roman had become the jungle itself. Every leaf, insect, and four-legged creature radiating with luminescence and infinite creative potential. He was everything and nothing. His physical form had dissolved fully into the night, and along with it, all the pain and discomfort it held. This was the first time Roman had ever experienced any type of vision or spiritual phenomenon during a ceremony. Until then, it had just been an ordeal of discomfort and purging, but everything shifted in this moment. He was now surrounded by light, and a female presence began to speak to him, telling him that he was healed. He knew it was true. He returned to his home a few months later and told his worried family what had transpired. They gently urged him to see a doctor and have tests done immediately. The tests came back showing no signs of Crohn's disease. Roman's digestive tract was completely healthy, with no evidence of the lesions and bleeding that had plagued his gut for more than a decade. Now at our gathering in Brooklyn, Roman goes on to speak of how Don Cinci invited him to come apprentice with him, now that the foreigner had passed the first threshold of shamanic preparation, healing oneself. The past decade of his life, he says, has been spent in the Peruvian outback, working with these traditions, deepening his understanding of how to use them to continue his own spiritual work and help others. The final hour of Roman's talk is more of a warning about what the ayahuasca ceremony entails, the emotions and shadows that can arise in one's psyche, and the physical purging and dizziness that usually occurs following the consumption of the jungle medicine. He finishes his talk, and I wait until the studio is mostly cleared out before I approach him. Roman stands from his cushion, not seeing me as he dusts himself off, and reaches for his bag. He looks up, and his eyes brighten. "You must be Nick," he says. "Cynthia told me to expect you tonight." "It's an honor to meet you, Roman," I say, feeling a smile overtake my face despite my efforts to maintain a professional distance. "I could tell you a story of three coincidences that led me here tonight, but somehow I don't think you'd be too surprised. I heard about this from Cynthia as well. Let's take it as a good omen that you and I were meant to meet," he smiles. "So, will you be joining us for a ceremony?" "Just like that, I'm in." "I don't know what in means. I'm simply asking if you would like to sit with us." "No excuses, I think. You've got to see where this leads."
"Sure."
December 11th, 2009, Newtown, Connecticut. I'm sitting in the tiniest room of a snow-covered New England country house, along with 12 other men and women. We're packed in like sardines, at the insistence of the Peruvian shaman who presides over the proceedings. The idea is for our tight circle to be so close that our knees almost touch. Slightly claustrophobic as I am, this is not an ideal setting for me, but I'm convinced that I've experienced enough vision-inducing drugs to tread these waters with relative grace. We all arrived around the same time, about an hour before the ceremony was scheduled to start. And other than a few casual hellos to one another, everyone has remained fairly quiet. The one thing I have picked up from the banter between a few of the women to my left is that this is a pretty advanced group whose members have sat in ceremony with Roman before. Looks like I'm the only rookie. As we sit in a candlelit ring, Roman gives us the following words of wisdom. "You will see many things tonight, some pleasant and some not so pleasant. My advice to you is to assume a comfortable position, focus only on your breathing, and try to be still. Proceed through the next 8 hours with an open heart, an open mind, like a child does, with no attachment whatsoever to what you witness, good or bad. You will most likely feel some disturbing emotions, visions, and thoughts. Don't push them away. Let them pass by, simply observing without connecting any meaning." You also may experience some beautiful sensations and imagery. The same principle applies to these. Do not reach for them or attach any significance. Simply notice. Envision yourself as a young child, sitting on the bank of a river, watching as leaves, branches, flowers, insects, and maybe some fish float and swim past you. The child simply watches, without injecting any ego or inner assessment into the passersby. Stay present with all that you experience. Focus on your breathing in times of difficulty, and try not to resist or cling to what you are about to see. You are everything. You are nothing. In this way, you can fully experience Grandma and go deeper with her. Seems simple enough. You each have a bucket in front of you, which you will most likely be using to purge at least one time tonight. Keep it close, and try not to confuse it with your neighbors. A few people chuckle at this. Apparently, this is something that happens. I feel the first pang of fear well up in my stomach. The shaman produces a small flute from his bag. Perched on the edge of his cushion, he looks at everyone in the circle, one by one, starting with the woman sitting immediately to his left, at 1 o'clock, and working his way around to the man sitting at 11 o'clock. His face is kind, but there's a graveness to his expression that activates a survival instinct in my gut. I'm at 7 o'clock, and as our eyes meet across the circle, the reality of what I've signed on for sets in. Roman plays a short and beautiful song on his flute to commence the ceremony, as his apprentice carefully places 2 clear bottles containing a brownish-orange substance on the floor in front of him. Once the melody is complete, he says a quick prayer in Quechua and begins to call people up to drink their cup. Some of us are completely meditative, holding pure space for each individual who approaches to receive the medicine. Others of us, myself included, are a little more restless. Even though the circle is small, I can't quite make out the short exchange of words between Roman and each recipient before they drink. I can, however, conclude that the beverage is not overly tasty, judging from their expressions after downing their cup, which range from a slight wince to controlled gagging. As the man next to me, sitting at 6 o'clock, stands to get his cup, the tension in my chest rises a notch. You got this. You've eaten mushrooms and other psychoactive compounds before. You'll be fine. The very presence of this positive inner coach is alarming. It only comes out when I'm about to endure something awful. Do what he said. Focus on your breathing. The two finish their exchange. Not wanting to show my fear, I get up with as much grace as I have in me and maneuver toward the center of the circle in front of the cross-legged shaman. Hello, Nick. How are you feeling? Scared. It's good to be afraid sometimes. Fear is not our enemy, and it often comes on the path of our own evolution. I'm happy that you are joining us tonight. Roman unscrews the top of the 1-liter plastic bottle by his knee and fills a small clay vessel roughly the size of a double shot glass. He lights a small stick of incense, known in South America as Palo Santo, and holds it over top of the cup while he prays in an indistinguishable language with eyes closed. When his blessing is complete, he hands me the cup. I bow and raise it to my lips with both hands. I do my best to let the thick, sticky liquid drop straight past my tongue, but the taste takes over my mouth nonetheless. A combination of bile, apricot juice, and alkaline battery. The gulp hits my stomach and immediately wants to come back up. Eyes watering, I do my best to bow again to the shaman and crawl back over to my cushion. A few minutes pass, and the feeling of nausea subsides, replaced by a renewed sense of general unease. After the final cup is administered, Roman fills it once more. He closes his eyes and prays very quietly to himself for a few minutes. His eyelids open, and he raises the cup to us all and says, "Salud," before downing its contents. His face doesn't contort like the rest of ours after drinking the brew. Instead, he seems to be taking in the flavor, searching with his taste buds for certain characters in the blend, almost like a wine connoisseur might let a sip linger on his or her tongue and carefully experience its effect of taste and smell. Putting the cup down, Roman meets eyes with us once more. "Because you are my advanced group and have all sat in ceremony with me quite a few times, well, almost all of you, I have a special gift from Grandma that you are welcome to try if you feel so inclined." The woman to his left, who is apparently one of his apprentices, pulls out an additional plastic bottle that, through the dim candlelight, seems to contain a similar substance. "Over the past year of carrying this batch, a sediment has formed on the bottom of our jugs that is, in essence, a concentrated ayahuasca toffee. In the jungle, we call it candy. This medicine is very potent, so I will only be giving one teaspoonful for those who would like to try it." As each person in the circle approaches the shaman and is served a teaspoon, two things suddenly occur to me. One, since I'm in an advanced group, this medicine is probably very strong. Two, nobody is saying no to the candy, and I won't let myself be the only one who does. Which means I'm about to double down on my ayahuasca dosage. Moments later, I'm seated in front of Roman, scraping the thick caramel goo off the teaspoon with my teeth and feeling it slide with a kerplunk into my digestive system. I go back to my spot in the sardine circle, fending off the urge to regurgitate, and sit down Indian style on a cushion. We sit, letting the digestive discomfort settle, for about 30 minutes in complete silence that is broken only by the occasional whisper, waiting for the medicine to come alive within us. In anticipation of what is about to happen, I can't help staring at the woman at 1 o'clock who drank first to see if there's any noticeable change in her manner or outward appearance as the ayahuasca takes hold. Nothing noticeable is happening unless she's a total master. Eyes are still peacefully open. Breathing seems normal. Vomit bucket is still pristine. Then I see it. Starting with Miss 1 o'clock, heads and bodies begin slumping, one by one, tipping like dominoes in order of who drank first. It takes only about 15 seconds for this wave of impossibility to make its way around the circle to me. It starts as a tingle up my fingers, into my arms, accompanied by a loudening hum. Within moments, I am enveloped by it. My strength and sensation of being in a physical form evaporates almost instantly, and it's not pretty. I'm panicking and beginning to struggle for breath. I dissolve into and through the floor, and all of my deepest fears come surging up through the darkness to greet me. A shrill voice in me cries out that I've made a terrible mistake ingesting this unknown potion, and that I'm dying. I'm tumbling through nothingness. The only remnants of the sardine circle are the distant echoes of a shaman singing his Ikaros, ceremonial prayer songs, to the beat of a drum. I am falling, clinging to any thought, desperately trying to get a foothold. But the only ledges and ropes offered for myself to myself are words of fear, shame, and sadness, each one building on the others. As the storm rages on, I become keenly aware of a pressure that is starting in my bowels and bubbling up through my stomach. I'm partly relieved to be feeling my body for a moment, but this is immediately replaced by panic at this growing sensation within me. I fight it, pushing it back down with all my might, Nobody else in the circle has used a bucket, and I don't want to be the first.
At least you're still there enough to care, Nick. Maybe you're not as lost as you thought.
And then it comes. The loudest, most ferocious vomit I've ever purged, right into my neighbor's throw-up bucket. The sound startles the entire room, and I hear my neighbor involuntarily laugh while whimpering at the intensity he's apparently in the midst of. I heave one more time, now deciding that this will be my bucket, and I lean back with a moan of my own. I hear a moan come from another spot in the circle, causing a chain of moans that bends back around to me, like one long snake working a sensation through its system. The purge seems to have stopped my descent into the hellfire abyss momentarily. I look across the room and see the shadow that is Roman bringing an object to his chest. He plucks a stringed instrument and begins to sing a haunting song that dips and soars, changing the shape, color, and dimension of the room with each note.
Ayahuasca la di di. Ayahuasca la di di. La di 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 di.
It's too much to bear. I'm swallowed by it again. Mid-somersault through the void, something unexpected happens. My right foot begins to ache from a recent running injury that's been nagging me for months. Just then, the first emotionally neutral thought enters my consciousness. My foot hurts so bad right now. In that moment, almost as if I hit pause on the TV, the free fall stops. I slowly open my eyes onto a whirlwind of cosmic activity happening in the darkness before me, but not in my immediate vicinity. The circle of bodies is covered in an explosion of geometric textures and images, too much for me to try and comprehend. Looking down in the direction of my welcome foot pain, I see that my right foot is now glowing a dim blue. The pain pulses one more time. Almost instinctively, I bring my left hand up to my face, and it ignites in the darkness. I place my now white hand on blue foot and watch with silent astonishment. The pain dissolves into the darkness, while the white glow engulfs the foot up to the knee. In that moment, I'm not attaching any words or emotions to the experience, simply witnessing with an empty mind what is in front of me. But this unbroken consciousness lasts only so long, and a moment later, I say a few innocent but ego-driven words to myself. I think I got the hang of this now. As if a trap door has opened underneath me, I fall back through the floor and into another terrifying plummet. The next few hours continue much like this, with periods of feeling lost and overwhelmed, followed by moments of respite that are achieved only by stopping my ticker tape of inner self-talk. I find that most words are hot, meaning they trigger freefall, but certain words can be said again and again like a mantra to bridge those moments of doubt that are often accompanied by self-chatter. The battle-tested words I hear myself using most are thank you, grandma, and love. Drinking ayahuasca is like letting the forest and all the laws that govern it into your body. This medicine shows you what is really there, who you really are, what this really is. If you've been telling yourself stories or spackling over holes, the jig is up as soon as you enter the circle. My mind is a constant stream of thoughts, primarily consisting of words and images. Some words are benevolent, but others carry a deeply negative charge that disturbs the harmony in my reality whenever conjured. The power of words isn't a new idea. It's a major talking point of self-help gurus who preach positive thinking and the law of attraction, something that helped me quite a bit earlier in life. Even in popular, non-hippie granola eater culture, the truth of that law is recognized. As they say, the pen is mightier than the sword. But this is all vanilla compared with the loving cosmic bitch slap that Grandma gives us. At the height of ceremony, she delivers direct analytics on each word I'm thinking and the implications for the integrity of my soul. It's grueling to be tossed around in the turbid waters of your own scattered, self-defeating, and excruciatingly potent thoughts. There are some images in the feed, but the majority of the inner dialogue, for me, is made up of words. As the ceremony howls on, I gradually learn how to quiet my mind and let the thoughts go. At a moment of total emptiness, I begin to feel the presence of a familiar and welcome feminine entity descend upon me. The tingle of soothing warmth flooding my system is such a contrast to the deep discomfort and semi-terror I've been feeling that my eyes begin to tear and my body shudders. Everyone talks about Grandma Ayahuasca, but I had always thought it was just another thread of rich tribal mythology. I was wrong. I am now in the presence of a feminine spirit who is communicating with me without using words. I am not looking at a woman in front of me in the dark. She is coming into my body through the top of my head and filling me up. Crazy, I know. You can't make this stuff up. She tells me she's proud of me for facing my own fears and suffering in order to find truth. I am with you now and will be for the rest of the night, even if you don't think I'm here. She encourages me to stay sitting up even though I'm exhausted. There is still a lot more she wants to show me. You may think I'm gone while you're working through a disturbance, but I promise I won't let you stray too far into the darkness. Are you ready to go deeper? I'm actually being offered a choice here. The volume on the suffering could actually be turned down if I ask. Just moments before, I would have done anything to make this stop. Hell, I thought I was going to die. Yet the knowledge that Grandma is real and is with me tonight has changed everything. Emboldened by her words of encouragement, I am shocked to hear myself communicating back that I am willing to go anywhere she takes me. Buckle up. I sit there in the whirling storm of the Earth Mother, or Pachamama, smelling of vomit and breathing very heavily, unable to get quite enough oxygen into my body. I begin to poke back at the beast that is me. Somehow, quintessential negative words like evil and bad don't seem to have any effect or induce free fall. I categorize them as benign for now. The derailing thought forms are much more slithery and disarmingly normal. Something as innocent as, I can't handle any more of this, becomes an immediately self-fulfilling prophecy, intensifying the experience to the point of near unbearability. Unless I can neutralize the emotion in the next moment, all energy and equilibrium leave me, and the level of visual and oral chaos gusting around me escalates as I hurtle downward out of my body into a sea of misery. But my recovery time is improving. I find myself in this purgatory for only a few minutes at a time now, before I remember the operating principle of emptiness and acceptance. As I'm learning the hard way, holding balance in these ceremonies requires the sitter to remain thought-free, something that is far easier said than done. I realize then that the absence of thought in our culture is associated with lack of intelligence, unrealized potential, laziness, another stale concept that I am discarding as of tonight. Thoughtlessness is highly underrated. Every 20 minutes or so, Grandma picks me up by the scruff like a pup and plops me into a new scenario, whether it's an actual change of location in place and time or the sudden onset of a deafeningly loud hum like 1,000 bees in my ears or a challenging bodily sensation that culminates in a forceful physical purge into my handy puke bucket. About 4 hours into the ceremony, I am getting used to the suffering and now understand the purpose it serves. But I am being brought closer and closer to my edge. And when I start to tailspin, the only thing that can right my vessel is stopping thought or calling on my newfound power words. When I briefly come back to awareness of my body, I find that I'm sitting directly on the bones of my butt with my back fully erect and both hands in the air directly over my head, with palms outstretched. I'm rocking forward and backward, thanking Roman for the powerful Icaros he is singing from across the room.
Ayahuasca wa di 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 di, ayahuasca la di 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 di. La di 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 di.
His haunting voice is not merely providing ambiance for our journey with Grandma. These ancient songs were spun together by the masters to bring everyone deeper into their intensity and strengthen the effects of the medicine. In one moment, the music can be torturously needling to the psyche and nerves. But then in another, when all seems lost, it can actually help you find your way back. Right now, I am making what appears to be a physical gesture of gratitude and humility to Roman, who sits somewhere in front of me in the hot blackness. Am I really grateful? Or am I striking this pose of gratitude to counter the disturbing feelings that his words are invoking inside me? I don't know, but questioning anything I'm doing in the moment is a total no-no if I want to stay above decks. After about 4 hours of learning how to stay afloat and right the canoe when it capsizes, I notice a very clear visual metaphor emerging. Inside me, not in my body, but inside me, there is a large pendulum sitting relatively motionless at this current moment. To its right live joy, elation, excitement, bliss, beauty, and ecstasy. On the path of its leftward swing live fear, sadness, grief, shame, and despair. Seems pretty obvious that the right side of the long pendulum arm is where the preferred experiences are. And for the first few hours tonight, those were what I was reaching for, chasing after the appealing visions and emotions that flashed across my ticker tape, while fighting to keep the more disturbing apparitions and emotions at bay. But a pendulum, by its very nature, swings. As I cling to the positive sensations, I'm in effect pulling my pendulum from its center, drawing it against the cosmic gravity by which it operates, cocking it back like the hammer of a revolver, so that even the slightest slip of the finger will send it crashing down, swooping through and past center into the opposite realm, the realm of suffering and disorientation. Similarly, when I indulge the resulting panic and despair with even more defeating thoughts and word forms, "Oh shit, I'm going to die," or my new favorite, "You pushed it too far this time, you'll never make it back. You're not strong enough to handle this. Roman and the others are going to know you're a phony now." I push the pendulum even deeper into that dark frontier. Now the slightest glimpse of comfort or hope will send it crashing back the other way, past center again, surging into the ecstasy that awaits on the other side. The result is a roller coaster ride that many experience in the stronger ceremonies. Not only with ayahuasca, but with any ancient rite of passage. These spiritual interventions are all about the same thing, bringing individuals into full contact with their fear, their mortality, and ultimately, their power. This is usually done via intentional intensity, whether that be the heat of a sweat lodge, the physical trial of a sun dance, or the consumption of a psychoactive substance like ayahuasca, peyote, San Pedro cactus, mushroom, or venom. After tonight, I will use a pendulum as an operating principle for ceremonies and life itself. Keep that arm still. Always. By 4 in the morning, our circle has lost its shape, morphing into a scattering of bodies in varying states of consciousness. Some are still in the throes of Grandma's teachings, sighing and whimpering now and then. Others are in deep sleep, unbothered by the lack of proper bedding. The room has become something akin to a hive, one writhing pile of bodies, curled up with little concern about the proximity of others. We've been through something together. The shared suffering and the space we've held for one another's vulnerability have forged a primal bond among us all. The notion of social awkwardness is thousands of miles away from us now. My elbow is touching another woman's foot, and part of my blanket is being used by my neighbor to the left. The room has become one living, breathing organism. My head is still humming as I walk down the stairs of the contemporary modern home into the living room. It's been only a few hours since Roman officially closed the ceremony with a prayer and a song he played on a crooked instrument resembling a dwarf guitar. The sun has just started to rise, and the little den behind me is full of slumbering bodies. I'm too awake to sleep. Reality has changed. Everything I thought I was, everything I thought this was, is so much simpler now. But within that simplicity is an infinite space that feels like home. All the stories about Nick are gone. There's been a purification, and all that remains is the essential me. And this essential me is thirsty. Weaving and bobbing on unsteady legs, I make my way through the living room in the direction of what I'm hoping will be the kitchen. From around the corner, I hear the chopping of knife on cutting board and quiet, light-hearted banter. I enter the kitchen and see two women busily chopping garlic and squeezing lemons at the counter. Any trepidation I might have felt the night before at the thought of walking into a conversation between two strangers is completely absent at the present moment. "Hi, I'm Nick," I think. Actually, I'm not sure who I am anymore. This prompts us all to laugh, and one of them comes over and gives me a big, loving hug. "My name is Erica," she says. "I was sitting next to you last night, remember?" I get another hug from the other woman. "I'm Sarah." Standing there, I'm struck by the fact that these two people seem like sisters to me now. I'm not used to being embraced by someone so intimately without some kind of sexual connotation, yet it's not there. There's a camaraderie and a clarity among us. Maybe it's because we three stepped over the edge together last night and faced our deepest, darkest terrors while purging our systems of everything toxic, physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual. But there's more to it than that. "Here, have some lemon and garlic water. It will settle your stomach." Sarah slides a freshly poured glass in my direction. It seems like the last thing my raw digestive tract would want right now, but I do as I'm told. As the bitter juice and chunks of garlic hit my stomach, the effect is not what I expected. The mixture actually settles my remaining queasiness and grounds my feet to the floor. The three of us sit down and begin to share our experiences from the ceremony. I'm struck by how different our journeys were. I assume that everyone in the circle was in free fall with me for half the night, but each of us has had a remarkably unique and intricate encounter with the medicine. More people trickle into the kitchen with the same kindred demeanor, exchanging hugs and grabbing a cup of lemon and garlic elixir. I haven't known these people for more than 12 hours, yet they are seeing me in the most open and honest state I've ever known. A bond has formed within our gang of survivors. We are a spirit family. A few hours later, I'm sitting on the stone hearth of a warm fireplace, connecting with a few of the men and women from the ceremony, when I hear my name called from the other room. "Nick, come with me." It's Roman. I walk into the kitchen and over to the back door, where I see him waiting. "I want to show you something." With that, he turns the knob and pushes open the door, carving an arc-shaped path in the thick snow outside. He remains in the doorway as the freezing winter air rushes into the cozy house. "Take off all your clothes," he says. What? That is the last thing on earth I want to do. Roman looks up at me as he takes his own shoes and pants off. Believe me, this will be good for you. I reluctantly do as he says, and out we walk, bare feet disappearing into about 12 inches of frozen powder with each step. My survival instincts kick into high gear as the skin on my feet, ankles, and calves is engulfed in white. We can't possibly last out here for more than a minute. I grew up in these parts and know that frostbite is a very dangerous thing to mess around with. Not wanting to fail this test of spiritual fortitude, I involuntarily begin to hunch and hug myself. Roman stops in his tracks and turns to face me in the yard. He sees what I'm doing, and his face breaks into a wide, childlike grin. We think we're so frail, don't we? Raised with so much fear. It wasn't always this way. He is standing casually, as if he were still inside the warm kitchen, rather than out in the bitter cold. Put the strongest man or woman out in the cold for a few moments, and they become overwhelmed with an urge to tense up, as though that will somehow keep the cold out. But if you can do the unthinkable and let the sensation flow into and through you, observing it without emotion or fear, letting it pass, your reality is transformed. As he speaks, the biting cold that is assaulting me from every angle begins to transform into something different. Information. A natural self-scanning mechanism begins, showing me where I'm blocked, where I need to let go. Your body knows what it needs to maintain equilibrium. Don't let your mind get in the way. As he's talking, my eyes begin to move to the tall and equally naked trees that loom up around us. In the dead of winter, everything is silent. But as we stand there, I begin to hear the birch and the pine. With each subtle creak and groan of living trees, my body becomes less shaky. The needling prickles of cold snow and winter air on my flesh melt away. Ah, he's connecting with the trees, Roman says to himself, or someone I can't see. Let's walk. I nod, as if the idea of walking through an Arctic landscape completely naked is old hat to me. Off we go, trekking through the woods, listening to the trees, rocks, and wind. 30 minutes later, we're still alive, and plodding our way over a rock wall toward a large frozen pond. Without communicating a word, he and I break into a run toward the ice. 2 full-grown men, completely naked, ice skating on bare feet in 15-degree cold, laughing like giddy children. The air and snow feel cold, but refreshing. How long can we stay out here without dying? I ask. You already died last night. No need to worry about that anymore. Just keep focusing on your breath. The breath is the only possession that we need in this life. 30 minutes later, as we casually approach the house in the final light of day, a thought crosses my mind. Either this was a huge spiritual opening, or I've gone mad and will need to have my toes amputated. Before opening the door, Roman turns to me and says, "Okay, I think we can do this movie together." Sitting in the warm kitchen a few moments later, I was startled to see that my feet and calves, which had been submerged in snow for more than 60 minutes, aren't even red. A warm bowl of soup is slid over to me across the kitchen counter as I put my clothes back on. Roman's words suddenly sink in. We're actually going to be making this documentary. The Healing Power of Fire and Ice. From the bathhouses of Europe to Native American sweat lodges, people have been using hot and cold to purify both body and spirit for millennia. In Mayan culture, a steam bath called the Temescal is used, like a sweat lodge, to detoxify the body during sickness, to connect to higher realms, and as a sacred place for women to give birth. Controlled exposure to hot and cold environments has many scientifically proven health benefits. It increases blood circulation, flushes toxins, and kills bacteria and viruses that can't survive at certain temperatures. It's interesting to note that indigenous cultures from opposite sides of the planet utilize very similar hot-cold techniques for health and wellness. Is it an innate understanding in us humans? Similar to the Maya Temescal, the Russian banya is a small bathhouse usually situated near a source of ice-cold water. This structure is used to harness the health benefits of intentional temperature variation. Found all over Eastern Europe, banyas often contain branches of fresh or dried leaves or herbs for bathers to hit or massage themselves with, further improving circulation, much like the bundles of herbs used by the Maya in Honduras, Guatemala, and Mexico. As with a temescal, or a traditional sweat lodge, participants in a banya come together to heal and purify in a communal setting. It's customary to take breaks in between sessions in a banya, during which bathers often cool off in a cold lake or roll around in the snow. The cycle of hot and cold is repeated in order to achieve the maximum health benefit. Cold on its own has been used as a means of healing since the ancient Egyptians, who recognized that cold can minimize pain and reduce inflammation. The ancient Greeks regularly bathed in cold water for the belief that it improved their vigor. Hippocrates, often referred to as the father of modern medicine, recommended a regimen of alternating temperatures, switching between hot and cold baths, to improve circulation and digestion. While heat relaxes, cold stimulates, and both can be utilized for healing. In addition to the many proven health benefits of hot and cold therapies, ancient peoples also understood these rituals to be medicine for the mind, spirit, and heart. Across cultures, the aim of hot and cold rituals is purification. The sweat lodge, temescal, banya, and bathhouse served as a sacred refuge where we can release physical, emotional, and spiritual toxicity. There is nothing I know of that awakens the soul like a hot steam, followed by a plunge into ice-cold water or snow. I think Hippocrates might agree. Although the examples I've shared here are specific to their regions, you can find ways to use hot and cold therapy in your own bathroom. It can be something as simple as aiming your shower head, even better if it's handheld, at a spot where you have aches and pains or tenseness, and switching between hot and cold water every 30 seconds. Just be careful with sensitive areas like the face and neck. We need to be a little adventurous to evolve and grow. Chapter 4. The Wall. Security is mostly a superstition. It does not exist in nature, nor do the children of men as a whole experience it. Avoiding danger is no safer in the long run than outright exposure. Life is either a daring adventure or nothing. Helen Keller. July 7th, 2010, Denver, Colorado. The team and I are staring at the wall. 3 weeks ago, we sent out an email to the online communities from our past documentaries, announcing that our next healing film would be taking place in the Amazon rainforest. If you know someone who is suffering from a serious illness and would be interested in putting the natural herbs and ceremonies of South American shamans to the test, please complete the attached application. We cannot guarantee a cure, but we are very optimistic that this region holds plants and protocols that the Western world is not yet aware of. We wanted to make sure that only serious individuals responded, so the remainder of the message was a fire and brimstone list of the many dangers and potential hardships that applicants might encounter on a jungle trip like this. While venturing to the tropical frontier of Peru wouldn't take us out of the Western Hemisphere, it would certainly take us beyond the safety and comfort of the modern industrialized West. We hope to get 2 or 3 good candidates this way, which would be a great start. 48 hours later, we're looking at more than 400 applicants from people around the world, men and women who have been failed by modern medicine and are looking for new answers to their illnesses. Breast cancer, Parkinson's disease, AIDS, MS, diabetes, depression, addiction, PTSD. Many of them are difficult to read because of the sheer desperation that is conveyed in the applicant's words. Some people are writing excitedly, having heard about the promised undiscovered herb medicines of the Amazon, but others are simply reaching out for any inkling of hope. We're only going to be able to take 8. Do all of these people really understand what they're signing up for? To make sure they do, I send out another gut check email to all applicants, reiterating the extreme conditions they will face if they are one of the 8 patients selected. Poisonous snakes, poisonous spiders, 100% humidity, complete solitary confinement in their own rustic jungle hut, no electricity, no modern plumbing, thousands of miles away from a modern medical facility, an infinite number of mosquitoes. Plus, we will be filming their entire experience, the good, the bad, and the ugly. For better or worse, this cuts the list of applicants in half. Now we're looking at 200 people who are willing to brave anything for a shot at a cure. We call each of these folks personally to get a better idea of their personality and make sure they are comfortable with the psychoactive plants that are used in some of the healing ceremonies. This whittles our list of 200 down to the grid of 100 remaining candidates adorning the wall. Dan, Michelle, and I stand in front of that wall for the better part of 2 days, debating who are the best fits. There's so much to consider. Do we want to stick to outdoorsy people who we know can handle the experience? Or would it be best to select people who will be challenged by the elements? Should we say yes to people with late-stage cancer and advanced Parkinson's? Or would it be wisest to stick with patients who do not have potentially terminal conditions? Every hour, the wall gets more complex. It is beginning to resemble our murder board on a TV crime show. It's early evening when we finally come to our senses and realize there's no way we can make a decision before Roman weighs in. I send Roman a quick email, hoping he is at his part-time apartment in the jungle port city of Iquitos. He's been busy making preparations on the other side of the equator, essentially overseeing the construction of a rudimentary Amazonian healing center that will serve as a setting for our living experiment. He's been calling me weekly from one of the few internet cafes in the entire province with decent enough bandwidth to place a Skype call, and it's still patchy. As of our last conversation, half of the structures had been erected by a team of locals on a remote plot of jungle about an hour's drive into the bush. We hear back from Roman within an hour. Moments later, the three of us are sitting around a laptop in my kitchen, speaking to him over a choppy Skype call. Roman initially feels we should choose 8 patients with somewhat less serious conditions like diabetes, depression, and addiction. He thinks it would be best to work with people who will be able to maneuver more easily in the jungle and who are not at risk of dying from their illnesses during the month-long healing journey. I look at Dan and Michelle. I understand your point, Roman, but I think it would be a good idea to read you some of these other applications. We spend the next 15 minutes reviewing a small group of profiles from some of our more desperate patients that really call out to us. I share some of my personal conversations with them and find myself advocating for a few in particular. They know this is their last shot and are going into this with a full understanding of what it could mean. The ayahuasca ceremonies themselves might be a powerful way for terminally ill patients to get a peek behind the curtain and process any fears around mortality. If it doesn't heal them, it could very likely give them a glimpse of where they are going once they make their final transition. By the end of the night, we finally agree on 8 patients who have a combination of health conditions. 3 people with cancer, stage 4 breast cancer, stage 4 neuroendocrine cancer, and stage 2 prostate cancer. A woman with Parkinson's disease, a woman with Crohn's, a woman with IBS, a man with depression and addiction, and a man with type 2 diabetes. Gary, Melinda, John, Nicola, Jessica, Gretchen, Juan, and Joel. 8 people with 8 different illnesses, who have each assured us that they are ready to do anything it takes to heal. I'll be calling each of them over the next 24 hours to give them the good news, but I still don't think they have any idea what lies